Ribble FM.
I'd like to introduce you to today's Backseat Driver Radio Show guest, precision driver Russ Swift. I'm sat in Russ's kitchen, deep in, shall we say, picturesque Yorkshire. Russ, welcome to the Backseat Driver Radio Show.
Well, thank you for coming. It's a pleasure to do this for you.
Now, the one thing is, I mean, precision driver, I suppose you could say stunt driver, because them that are not sure what a precision driver is, stunt driver probably describes it a little better. I mean, how did you get into all this? Because, I mean, it's not what you'd call a career that immediately springs to mind, is it?
No, my involvement started in motorsport and... Initially, I was a navigator on rallies and did that for a couple of years until I spotted the sport of auto testing and thought I could afford to do that and be competitive at it. Because I didn't have a big income. I was just an apprentice in an engineering work, so most motorsport was out of my reach. But auto testing is a sport you could do at the time very, very cheaply and be competitive without a massive outlay on a car.
Now, auto testing, it's like, it can be done on the field, it can be done in the car park, and it's basically driving a car around a series of cones in a predetermined sequence that you've got to learn, or else you'll see a lot of auto test guys have a piece of paper stuck on their windscreen so they technically still know where they're going. And it's very precise driving, like handbrake turns, high-speed reverses, and all sorts of things. Is that? And to my knowledge, like you said, it has got to be the cheapest form of motorsport, because if all else fails, you can use your wife's Vauxhall, Corsa, or whatever, anything like that, or you can go out and nick your mum's Mini.
That's right, you can enter an auto test with very, very basic safety checks to make sure that the car isn't going to be dangerous, make sure that the brakes do work properly, and make sure your seat's firmly fixed down. But you can do it in absolutely anything. And if you're a natural and if you're enthusiastic enough, you can be competitive. If you want to become the British champion, you've got to...
Which you did.
After 10 years of competing, I eventually won the British Championship, and it my car just evolved over the years to get myself to the level where I could compete at the top level. But it still is cheap compared with all other forms of motorsport. And
I mean, what did he use? Was it a Mini? Because, I mean, at one point in time, the Mini was the, like, auto-test benchmark, wasn't it?
Yes.
That's all you used to see.
At the time, 40 years ago now, to win the British Championship, you had to use a Mini.
Yeah.
It was the most manoeuvrable, the most agile car for the job. Other people before and since have used specials, homemade specials, and things like Caterhams, Lotus 7s, and MG Midgets. But a Mini probably still is the car to beat on auto testing. And I started off in a Beetle. I was the navigator for the managing director of a local Volkswagen dealership, and I navigated him for a couple of years in this Beetle, and went along to a British Championship auto test where the British champion actually drove a Beetle.
Yeah.
And that's what made me realise that I could actually become a driver. And and so I bought a Beetle for £200 and started doing local events.
Yeah.
Eventually we got together a team and represented the northeast of England at national events. But then I realised that to be British champion, I'd have to swap to a Mini. And 1976, I bought my first Mini and went on to win British championships in 82 and 83.
Because, I mean, you were also quite a successful rally driver, weren't you?
That came as a direct result of the success in auto testing. My local Vauxhall dealer suggested I'd drive one of his cars because we were getting quite a bit of publicity and quite a following. And at the time, there was a championship called the Astra Challenge, which was for virtually bog standard Astra cars. And it was all down to the driver. I'd never driven on a rally before, or never been in a forest, and started off, I think it was 15th on the first round of the championship, but the last round we actually won, and I scored points in every event of the championship, and so my consistency showed, and the prize for winning the championship was a works supported drive for international rallies. I didn't actually win the championship, I came second, but they saw the potential in me and supported me, and the next year, which was 85, we did the Circuit of Ireland, the Ulster, the Manx, the RAC, Scottish, the Welsh. And that's when I started doing my displays.
Yeah. So I'm going to say, I mean, from rally driving and auto-assessing, where did the displays come from? I mean, you didn't just go out and start displaying cars. I conclude somebody had to ask you if you wouldn't mind doing it.
Yeah, that's right. I was British champion at the time, and coordinator for a rally event in the northeast of England asked me if I would entertain the spectators in the lunch break at this one single venue rally stage. And I flew up and down the stage, going backwards and forwards, sprinting around, doing my handbrake turns, and got paid £40 to do it. And I thought I was onto something here, yeah. And it did go down really well. And as a result of that, I was asked to perform at the Longleat Safari Park on the RAC Rally that year, and that I got paid £100 yeah. for that. And at the time when I was sponsored by Vauxhall doing the rally, and I started doing events at their GM Trophy days at various circuits around the country, just one off displays, but it grew and grew over the next few years till I eventually had to make the decision to go full-time at it.
Yeah. I mean, I conclude it's, in a strange sort of way, it's been a very good life to you. It's not a form of motorsport that most people consider. Or most people who want to drive cars professionally for a living want to race and rally and whatever. I mean, you do the complete antithesis, really. I mean, don't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's I enjoyed the rally, and but I always realised that you're up against it without a big budget, and but I thoroughly enjoyed the auto testing and just the technicality of it, and
I mean, just putting it, I conclude it's like a mindset, isn't it? You've got to want to actually.
Oh yes.
For in auto testing, it's not that. Yeah, it is speed that counts, because you're against the clock a lot of the time.
All the time, yeah. It is fractions of a second.
But it's shall we say very close quarters motor racing.
Precision. It is. Yeah. That's where the precision comes from, and that's. And it's that skill that I learned at auto testing that I've adapted to perform with displays. And that's why people are impressed when I do a display, because they're impressed how close I can get to something without hitting it.
Well, I mean, the famous manoeuvre is like handbrake turning one car to park between two already parked cars, isn't it?
That's right.
The famous manoeuvre that most people are impressed by, because everybody waits for you to hit one of them.
Well, I mean, that was sort of a godsend to me, really. It came up by accident on a TV commercial I did in 1988, and the manoeuvre that I'd planned to end this commercial with was a bit too exciting for the Advertising Standards Authority. So, well, can you come up with something else that's equally as impressive but not quite as dramatic? And I'd been doing a manoeuvre where I'd do a handbrake turn in behind another car and park very close to the bumper. I thought, well, if you stuck another one in behind, it wouldn't make any difference to how I did it, but it would look so much more impressive.
Yeah.
And nobody had ever done it before, and when the TV commercial came out, it was that manoeuvre that caught everyone's imagination and made the commercial so successful.
Yeah. I mean, when you're setting a car up for doing this, how much work goes into altering or modifying your car to make it do the stunts?
Very, very little. I put a little bit of extra pressure in the tyres so that the tyres don't roll off the rim. I make sure the handbrake is really effective, so it locks the wheels precisely and exactly as you want it to. And sometimes I stiffen the shock absorbers up a little bit, but apart from that, I try to use very, very standard cars.
Yeah,
a manoeuvre that I mastered after I started doing my displays to complement it was the driving on two wheels, and for that you've got to lock the differential.
Yeah,
because when you go under two wheels, it just spins the wheel in the air, doesn't drive the wheel on the ground. So it means you can keep moving once you are on two wheels.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I try and use cars that everybody in the street can actually relate to.
Yeah. I mean, the two-wheel one, I mean, there's got to be, if you don't mind me asking, how many times do you get it wrong before you get it right?
Hundreds of times. I spent 3 months rolling on my roof, basically, before I was confident enough to go to a manufacturer and say, give me a brand new car.
Yeah.
I'm not going to roll it. And
I conclude you built a car to be able to keep using again and again to do that.
I bought a car that had already been rolled, so it needed reshelling anyway. So so that, I was off to a good start there, and it was a far more economical way of doing it. And But I did, there was nobody to teach me how to do it. I just decided I was going to do it. Other people could do it, so I was going to have a go, and I spent weeks and weeks practicing and practicing till I got to the stage where...
I think the famous film where it was first seen for many was Diamonds Are Forever with Sean Connery as
Jason, right,
because they used the Mustang Mach-1.
That's right, yeah.
Which doesn't strike me as the most feasible car to want to use a Mustang Mach-1 to do it in, or can it be done in anything?
It can be done in anything. The biggest thing I've driven, not on two wheels, but on three wheels, because it was a six-wheeler, it was an 18-ton Steyr truck in Austria. But I've driven London taxis, yeah. 7.5-ton trucks, sports cars, Triumph TR5, a classic car, you know, very low centre of gravity, MGTF.
Yeah.
The lower the centre of gravity, the harder it is to balance a car on two wheels, because you've got to get it up to a much steeper angle. So,
without giving trade secrets away, encouraging anybody to go and do it, what's the trick of doing it?
It's just like riding a bike slowly. Whichever way it's falling, you turn into it to stop it falling that way. I drive up a ramp to get myself somewhere near the point of balance,
yeah,
and then I turn in to get it actually at the point of balance, and from then on it's like balancing a stick on the end of your finger. You've got to react to it before it gets so far that you can't stop it falling.
Yeah.
It's a balancing act.
Your right. Local radio station for the Ribble Valley. On air, online and on your smartphone app. Ribble FM.
Just because.
106.7 Ribble FM.
Looking to turn your precious memories, holiday snaps, sports shirts, family heirlooms into gallery quality showpieces? Then head over to Bespoke Picture Framing by Alexander, located on York Street, Clitheroe. With over 150 five-star reviews, Alexander handcrafts every frame with museum quality glass options to preserve your treasures for years to come. He frames everything from prints and paintings to vinyl records and odd keepsakes. Oh, and he loves a challenge. So whatever you need framing, Alexander's your expert. Bespoke Picture Framing by Alexander. Bring in your memories. Walk out with art.
Premier Chadburn Village Store does exactly what it says on the tin. A local convenience store, run by local people, that offers the cheapest 24/7 pay-at-the-pump fuel, comprehensive range of groceries, and we're also a payzone provider for bill payments and mobile top-ups. Open from 6am until 9pm, we're here when you need us.
Chadburn Village Store, open when you need us most.
Get ready to bring a slice of real Italy to your next event with Tuk Tuk Pizza Company, where gourmet meets fun. The finest Neapolitan-style pizzas cooked fresh in our bespoke pizza pods. Imagine the sight of sizzling melted cheese, raised dough, and that telltale aroma of homemade garlic butter. There's nothing like it. No matter what the occasion, Tuk Tuk Pizza Company is your go-to. And here's the twist. Our two chefs don't just cook. They have entertainment and theatre to serving your food, making every slice a performance. Book us now and let us turn your next gathering into a spectacular feast of flavours and fun. Find us on the socials or call 01200 40 73 74. Tuk Tuk Pizza Company.
Spring has sprung in the Ribble Valley, and it's blooming beautiful at Shackleton's Home and Garden in Chadburn. Discover vibrant, colourful pot plants, sprouting bulbs, and stunning specimen trees ready to bring your garden to life. Thinking ahead to summer? Our huge range of stylish garden furniture is ready for you. Lovely looking lawns, colourful beds, stunning furniture. Make a day of it and visit our store in Chapman. Shackleton's. Experience different.
There's a place at the foot of Pendle Hill where time just slows down. Welcome to the Barley Mow in Barley. A proper country pub filled with crackling log fires, cosy corners, and that warm, familiar feeling the moment you step inside. Settle in for a hearty pub foodie favourite, a perfectly poured pint, and the friendliest welcome in the village. And if you can't bear to leave, stay over in one of our premium ensuite rooms. This weekend, make it the Barley Mow. Comfort, charm, and a seat waiting just for you.
Tried sipping on the champagne, but it's always gonna be Jack. There's things I can't change, like how I was raised. The Bible in my blood and the Bama in my veins. Ain't a pink bouquet in the flower store. I'm okay if I'm a little more. Dandelion, born to live free, riding on the breeze on a summer night. Tucked back in the wheel.
on a summer night. Tug back in the weeds, guess that's
smartphone app. 106.7 Ribble FM.
It might seem a daft question. Can you do it on every set of wheels? Can you do it like on the right hand side and then drop it down and then pop it up on the left ones? Provided you have a ramp to let you do
it. You can, but it's much more comfortable and you have much more control if you're at the bottom. I do half of my work is with left hand drive cars. A lot of my work over the years has been overseas and most places to drive on the other side of the road. So I'm driving left hand drive car. But through choice, I would always drive from the bottom because you're not being thrown around so much at the top. And you can actually lean into it. As you go up the ramp, you can lean into the car. If you're on the outside, you sort of to make yourself upright, you sort of got to hang out the window, really.
Yes.
So the car comes to you as you go up on the two wheels, and then you can let it fall away from you when you drop it back down again.
If you don't mind me asking, what piece of land did you use to teach yourself to do this? Because, I mean, you will need a decent bit of land to go and do it on.
Well,
preferably tarmac, I should imagine.
Well, it's all right. I wish you'd told me that when I first started, because I started off in a farmer's field that was very, very bumpy and rutty and that was probably half my problem for the first couple of days when I was doing it. But at the time, Croft Motor Racing Circuit was about 5 miles from where I lived, and it wasn't being used for anything else at the time. And I got permission for the farmer to leave my car there and then just pop down for a couple of hours every now and again to
have a do.
To have a do, yeah. And that was a big help to me. You know, without having somewhere like that, I probably wouldn't have been able to do it.
I suppose the only thing was, people MC and think, what's this bugger?
Well, used to practice behind a load of trees, I always used to have a team of people come along with me to push me back onto
wheels. Back onto wheels.
In the end, I was having to steer from the bottom of the steering wheel because the roof was touching the top of the steering wheel.
Don't mind me asking, what sort of car was it?
It was an Astra. It was at the time driving for Vauxhall in 1985 when I was doing the internationals. So I had good contacts with Vauxhall, and we picked up this write-off that was ideal for me to master. And then after I'd finished practicing with that car, somebody reshelled it and put it back on the road.
So somebody could still be driving around.
Yeah, that car could still be on the road now, yeah.
Now, with all this, it's like we were saying a little earlier on before we went on air, you've done your precision driving and stunt driving all over the world, haven't you? Plus also for some serious manufacturers.
Yeah, so I've probably driven for most manufacturers now over the time. That TV commercial where I did that parking manoeuvre was 1988, and the TV crews came from all over the world. That TV commercial won a major award at the Cannes Film Festival. It was voted the most imaginative TV commercial of 1988 in America.
Yeah.
And it got me recognised worldwide as being able to put on these sort of things. Unfortunately, that commercial was only ever shown in this country, and it was only ever shown for 6 weeks. Probably because it was banned. I don't officially know that, but I know it did cause quite a furore at the time, and there was a lot of consciousness that these sort of things that I was doing in that commercial might be seen as being irresponsible. From then on, I immediately after that, I was invited to go to Malaysia to launch the Proton brand, and we did a tour of every state in Malaysia doing a very similar display to what I was doing in this country, and it was a massive success. And the next year, we were asked to go and do it again, repeat the whole thing, because it was so successful. But I was asked to perform in Korea for Kia, Hyundai. I performed at the New York Motor Show, Melbourne Motor Show, South Africa. Did several TV commercials in South Africa. So it did that one commercial launched my career.
Yeah.
worldwide.
And I mean, from there, besides that, I mean, you've done plenty of other TV work and film work. I mean, can you let us into a little into some of the other stuff you've done, whereby all of a sudden when you sit and watch your film, you think that's real sweet.
I've never actually done any filming for films. There's a different body of people that do that sort of thing. I'm not on the stunt register, because I don't qualify, because I can't sword fence or I can't horse ride, or there's some very strict guidelines to how you can get onto the stunt.
So you've got to be able to do more than one.
You've got to be competent at sort of instructor level at various things. I've been fortunate to have enough work doing what I love, basically the driving, and never felt the need. And then for films, it's a lot of commitment. You've got to know you're free to take on these jobs for a long time, and be available. I've found my own little niche TV commercials. I can go and do those in a week or a few days. And the live shows have kept me busy for the last 40 years.
Because one of the live shows you became very well known for was Top Gear Live, wasn't it?
Yes, that started. We were doing displays at the NEC for events like the Classic Car Show, and it was decided that it could be expanded on, and so the shows were developed where it was more about action than just an add-on to a certain show. The Top Gear Live show that went worldwide. It started in the UK to show the success, but it went to South Africa and Russia, all over the world, presented by the TV Clarkson and May and Hammond, it was very satisfying to be involved in those things, because we could elaborate on what I did and make it more spectacular with pyrotechnics and music. But I think one of the the British Motor Show we did in 2001 to launch the Mini really brought it to international motor shows.
The BMW Mini.
Yeah. We launched it in Manchester to the press and the media, it was decided that we would approach the British Motor Show to see if they would let us put on a live show there.
Yeah,
and it went down really, really well. It was a massive success, and as a result of that, the organizer of the British Motor Show decided that it should be Motor Show Live and encourage other manufacturers to do live things at the show. But we went back the next year, and I would like to think we sort of stole the show with the displays we put on.
Now, the one thing is, all these displays, I suppose you could say it's like ballet on four wheels. Where do you start? How does the display evolve? How does it come about? And how do you keep it fresh? How do you think of something new?
Well, my displays are handbrake turns, reverse spins, and a bit of two-wheeling.
Yeah.
And then it's just all variations of that, really. I've got a fairly standard routine that I've performed for 30.
F1 course. I mean, how do you plan that out?
There wasn't a great deal of planning when I was first approached. It was for a promotion called Join the Pact. Mm. And the Formula One drivers sort of use their platform to tell people to never drink and drive.
Yeah.
And you would sign up to this commitment by signing your name, and someone came up with the idea of signing the name in the tarmac with skid marks.
Yeah.
So first of all, I did it with Jensen Button and Mika Hakkinen, who were the Mercedes 63 powerful rear-wheel drive car, and that went down quite well. And after that, we got involved with Lewis Hamilton in a McLaren. We did that at Singapore.
Yeah.
Writing his name in the tarmac, and Sergio Perez did that with him as well. And then my son did it with Michael Schumacher before he had his accident. So, it's some of the cars are more difficult than the others. Certainly, the McLaren was a very difficult car to do that with, because there's so many electronic aids built into the car that once you start doing what we wanted to do with it, it just said, I'm not having any of that.
Yeah.
And so we had to overcome all little aids to allow us to do it. But in the end of the day, we always managed.
Now, as regards the modding cars, though, of course, you'll do it with anything. Do you have a chosen modding car to do these these stunts and tricks with? Do you think, well, if I'm allowed to choose myself, unless it's a particular manufacturer who wants, of course, you to use their cars.
Yeah.
If somebody says, can you do this? We're not bothered what you come in. Do you have a chosen car? Because you said some are easier to do these things with than others.
Well, no, I tend to work for manufacturers now, so yeah. I'll make their car do what I want it to do, yeah. Really. Most of my work for the last 20 years has been for Subaru in Asia, performing at all the international motor shows out there, Bangkok Motor Show, Singapore Motor Show, Saigon Motor Show. And they have the four-wheel drive cars, they have rear-wheel drive cars with the BRZ, and some of the four-wheel drive cars that can make front-wheel drive for me. So I'll turn up and have...
I was just going to say then, I conclude a four-wheel drive car is not your best friend as such, because it won't really want to do what you want it to.
Yeah, but you get a four-wheel drive car doing donuts and high-speed drifts, and it's pretty spectacular. Yeah. So we normally finish the show off with a four-wheel drive WRX STI disappearing into small bits.
So, but if you're doing a routine with a four-wheel drive car, do you vary your routine to compensate for how that car feels and reacts?
Yes, and I'll use different cars for different things. And so the two-wheeler, you can use rear-wheel drive, four-wheel drive, front-wheel drive, so it doesn't really matter on that. But some of the manoeuvres... The four-wheel drive really does hold you back a bit. If you want to sort of spin around quickly, they do want to hang on and grip. And it's an omni matter of, with Subarus, they don't do a front-wheel drive car. So we remove the rear prop shaft and weld up the centre diff, and it just makes it a front-wheel drive car. And we perform, certainly with the parking manoeuvre, that makes it easier for that and some of the other manoeuvres we do. But we modify the cars as little as we possibly can, so that people can, at the end of the day, I'm performing for a manufacturer, and I want to warm people to the brand with cars they can relate to.
Listen to Ribble FM anytime, anywhere. Download our dedicated smartphone app. Go to ribblefm.com.
106.7 Ribble FM.
Ever feel like creating a website is like trying to juggle while riding a unicycle? Well, juggle no more. Introducing 50 to 1 Media. We make the designing of your website as easy as pie. We offer complete web development and implementation. And we'll make sure Google loves your website as much as you do. From domain purchasing to hosting, turning your site into a Ribble Valley rockstar, we've got you covered. So why not drop in for a brew and let's chat about how 50 to 1 Media can turn your web woes into web wows. Visit 50to1media.co.uk, because who needs a unicycle when you have us? That's 50, the number 2 and the number 1.co.uk.
Three-phase contractors, your local Eco4 specialist.
How would you like to cut energy bills and upgrade your home, all for free? You could get a government-backed grant covering the full installation of solar panels, heat pumps and insulation, absolutely free. And it takes just 1 minute online to check if you qualify. Don't miss out. Visit threephasecontractors.com today. Your 1 minute eligibility check could change your home forever.
Three-phase contractors, your local
Hey, have you lost weight?
No, I've just had my bra fitted properly, so everything is right where it should be. Remember, any good outfit starts with the right foundations. If your boobs aren't up where they should be, being supported and making you feel comfortable, then nothing is going to look or feel right. You wouldn't put a size 7 foot in a size 3 shoe now, would you? Perfect Fit by Carol, with more sizes than you can imagine, and fitting so easy. There's no tape measures involved. It's practically magic. You'll wonder why you didn't visit sooner. Visit them on King Street, Clitheroe, or check out their Facebook page. Perfect Fit by Carol, getting you your perfect fit.
It's time to get away with a foldaway. Escape to the country with one of our folding mobility scooters. Here at Modern Mobility, we understand the importance of keeping your independence and enjoying days out with your family and friends. We have some of the lightest and quickest folding mobility scooters, so you don't have to miss out on anything. With easy payment options and friendly experts on hand at all times, finding your ideal scooter has never been easier. Why not visit our shop, located on Castle Street, or give us a call on 01200 760 006 and discover your perfect staycation scooter now.
It's time to redecorate, and Clitheroe Decorating Centre has you covered with a wide range of paints, including high-end designer brands like Benjamin Moore, as well as Crown, Dulux and Emperor, and to top it off, all the tools you might need to get the job done. Seeing a colour you like? Check out our colour wall or our paint matching service, which is available to all our customers, both trade and retail. Our friendly staff are always on hand to help offer best advice, tips and tricks. Just some of the benefits dealing with a local family-owned and Ribble Valley Business Award-winning store. Come browse our in-store exclusive offers at Clitheroe Decorating Centre on Shawbridge Street, Clitheroe, or give us a call on 01200 426 342.
across the Ribble Valley, 106.7. This is Ribble FM.
So I completely, when you're doing something with, say, Subaru, depends on what the stunt is. You will talk to them and say, well, this needs doing to the car, that needs to the car, to allow the stunt to take place.
Yeah.
And I completely, they're quite happy to do this for you.
Oh, they love it. It's, it's, well, when I first performed for Subaru, it was for the dealer in Singapore, for the Singapore Motor Show, who put himself forward saying, will you use Subarus? We were very keen on, you know, to have Russ doing this thing for us. And he just had a dealership in Singapore.
Yeah.
And over the last 20 years, he's expanded into 10 different countries. He's now got two manufacturing plants. One in Malaysia and one in Thailand, assembling Subarus because they can't keep up with the demand. For he is selling so many cars that that he has to manufacture them himself, and he's using.
Do you get any royalties for this?
I don't get any royalties, but we've got a very, very close relationship with the company, and we have a team of mechanics that travels everywhere we go. They'll fly in with the modified parts and modify the cars.
Yeah,
a couple of days before I get there, and then we just drop on them and do the shows, and it works remarkably well.
Now, one thing, nothing to do with precision driving. One thing you also used to do, you used to manufacture convertible minis.
Yes, I did. At the time when I in the mid '80s, when I was rallying the Vauxhalls, that was my main income for auto testing. Nowadays, to win with a Mini, you've got to lighten it as much as possible, and visibility is very important with auto testing. So if you chop the roof off,
so just what a lot of the Mini specials you now see auto testing, some of them look a bit like a Mini Morgue, but they've got a normal Mini's front on.
That's right. Yeah. Well, at the time I was dead against that because auto testing at the time. And the reason I got into it, because you could just use a standard car, and there was strict rules that if you did an auto test, the car had to be able to be driven there and had to pass an MOT and had to have lights and everything like that. And at the time when I was British champion, it was when a lot of specials were being built and rules were being relaxed. And when I won the British Championship, I had to compete against people who would chop the roofs off their Minis and had no lights and it sort of detracted from the appeal of the sport for me because it made it far more specialised. But
now the other thing is as well, it really ramps the price of it.
It certainly does. Yeah, you've got to sort of put a lot more effort into being competitive. But the word got out about what we were doing with auto test cars. Not that I ever did. I actually ran a Morgue. I won the British Championship in a Morgue because I didn't want to do it in a special, really. Yeah. And I was sort of quite vocal about that at the time. But other people did it, and I thought of the idea of making one for the road, and I was approached by two girls who were sent to me by the local Ford dealer for some reason. They were looking for a beach buggy or something like that, and I said, well, I was thinking about making the Mini convertible. Would that appeal to you? And they said, oh, that sounds fantastic. So I said, well, it's going to give me 3 months. I've got a car here. I'm going to do it. If you like it, buy it off me. And I made it, and it was I was really pleased with how it turned out.
Yeah.
And they bought it, and from then on it just snowballed, and I was knocking one of these things out every week. It was my income for, you know, the mid '80s till the displays took over. But I was asked to perform in 1989. At the Mini 30th celebrations at Silverstone, and Rover asked me if I would convert one of my cars to perform a display in, and I thought it'd be strange at the time because it wasn't a production model, so why would they want to showcase
one of their own cars?
Yeah. So, but they said, oh, no, we would like people to see how you drive. People can see when there's not a roof off, see what you're doing. But in actual fact, at the back of their mind, they were thinking of bringing out their own convertible. They'd seen how popular they were. And so the next year, they gave me a car to convert. And then they took it away and did a design exercise at Warwick University, studying different designs from different people. And then when they finished with it, said, you know, we finished with this car, do you want to buy it back? So I did.
Yeah.
And that was the last one I did. But the next year, they brought out their own mini convertible, which they sold for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
Didn't sell in massive numbers, and this conversion was far more sophisticated than mine. But I bought that car off them. I've still got it to this day.
Yeah.
It's sort of a car that I'll hang on to.
Now, besides demonstrating and displaying modern cars over the years, the one thing you are also known for is your passion for classic cars. We won't quite go into, unless you want to tell us what you've got. I mean, it's interesting that somebody drives modern cars for a living as such, loves the classics. I mean, what is it about the classics you like? Because as time's going on, and with what's been happening over the past few months, the passion and interest in classic cars is going up.
Right, I can believe it. I try and get to as many classic car shows and classic car events as I can. It's a social thing as much as anything else. Over the years, I've got to know lots of people in the motor trade and in the classic
car. Well, that's how you and I met initially.
At that show, I'll just chat away to all the people that with similar interests to me, and we have a great time. But I think it's driver involvement. I like to sort of feel that I'm actually doing something with the car.
Yeah,
and I feel that modern cars sort of this too sterile. I mean, when you get in a classic car, you really got to drive it, and you really got you make a difference you got to concentrate on it, and then you get yourself a sense of sort of satisfaction from driving them sympathetically and getting the most out of them.
Yeah.
But I've still got the Beetle that my mum bought in 1972 when I started auto testing.
Yeah.
My mum passed the test when she was 50, and because of my association with the Volkswagen dealership and running the rally car and the auto test car, we got a good deal on it. And unfortunately, my mum died a few years ago now, but, I've still got that same Beetle, and like the mini convertible, that's 30 years old now. I converted that in 1989, 1990.
Yeah.
And I've kept that. I've still got the twin cam Escort that we're riding very briefly in the 70s. It was abandoned. It was a wreck.
Yeah.
When I actually only borrowed the car, I didn't own it, but abandoned it in 1980, and a few years ago a friend of mine said, do you remember that Escort you rallied? And I could hardly remember it, and he said, well, it's still where you left it in 1980. So I went and bought it off the owner, who was glad to get rid of it, this heap of scrap out of his garage, and I restored that to nice road going condition. So I've built up my collection of cars based on the cars that have been important parts of my career. But fortunately, since I've sort of been more successful and been able to make a good career out of it, the money I've generated has gone into building up a bit of a collection of nice cars. I don't have a pension.
Yeah.
My pension is my classic cars, which I love using. I've got about 10 now, but they all get used, and they're all, you know, cars that in the 50s and 60s when I was growing up, I would have
looked to one.
Yeah,
well, look around your collection. There's some pretty significant cars or significant models of cars.
Yeah,
from the Mini Coopers, twin cam Escorts. Because you showed me under the bonnet, and sat under there is a genuine Lotus twin cam engine.
Yeah.
You happen to like Aston Martins and Jaguars and AC Cobras. I mean, each one is iconic in its own way.
That's right. And I just consider myself so lucky to be able to actually own cars like that.
Yeah.
Now, I could only have dreamed about. And I think that's what a lot of the classic car ownership's all about. And it's good that sort of the younger generation have got the same enthusiasm.
Yeah.
The cars that are having the real boom in values at the moment. So the cars are 20 years old, 30 years old.
Yep.
And the cars that people couldn't aspire to in the day or envied or lusted after, they could never afford. And once they've built up a little bit of wealth, they can actually afford and indulge in the passion.
Now, if you could only choose, if they all had to go buy one, which is the one you would keep?
Oh, that's too difficult. It's like which is your favourite child, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, I mean, my mum's Beetle. I've got very little value, really, monetary, but a lot of interest there. And then the mini convertible, the twin cam Escort, they've all got sort of sentimental and sort of emotional attachments. But I always remember as a young teenager, when the, what was it, about 11, when the AC Cobra was brought out, and it was sort of a legend, really. Yep. And
the car was legendary, as was the man that invented it.
That's right.
The way it's been going a long while, it was Carroll Shelby who came along and did the bit, turned them into an absolute Ferrari.
That's right. And sort of the films are out now to celebrate that Le Mans. And it's a remarkable story. But I had an AC Ace, which was the predecessor to
very nice, quite a delicate car.
Lovely, lovely car, and a real driver's car. Beautiful engine, and I'm very, very lucky to buy that off a friend. I pestered a friend for many, many years before I managed to prize it out of him. And but there's a very good AC owners club, and after a few years, this Cobra that I've got now became available. But it wasn't common knowledge, the full history of this car, because they wanted to make sure that it went to the right person to do justice to it. The chap I had bought it off has had it 40 years, and he at the time when he bought it, he just sort of kept it on the road very, very cheaply, and had all sorts of bodges done to it, and had never been improved since. So it was in a bit of a sorry state when I got it, but over the last 5 or 6 years, I've restored it to its original condition. And that is a very, very special car, which I'm really lucky to own.
If there's one not out there that you'd like, what is it?
I'm just so lucky.
You walk around the classic car show,
this week I've bought a Lotus Elan Sprint, which was one car that I've always admired and respected, and I know of still. A few of them that people have that won't part with them, although they'll never get them on the road, they won't work. And I was very fortunate last week to come across one that was really local, and that's my winter project. All my work has dried up at the moment because of this COVID, so I'm a bit of a loose end. But
you're finding things to occupy yourself.
I am, yeah, and that's you know, I'm looking forward to doing the same with this little Elan Sprint as I did with the Cobra, and turn it into a very nice car.
Russ Swift, it's been a pleasure. Yorkshire's own precision driver. Thanks so much for joining me on the Backseat Driver Radio. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you.
And you.
Live and local, across the Ribble Valley, we are Ribble FM. For local radio, it has to be Ribble FM.